Of course, that's an extraordinarily interesting, rich, order theoretic structure. But it's not only an order theoretic structure. It's a topological structure. It carries several different, very interesting topologies. And it's also, in a sense, a symmetric structure. It's acted upon in very rich ways by groups. And of course, as we all know, all of that symmetry, and in the background, that topology as well, is in play in quantum mechanics. So it's always seemed to me that it would be, at a minimum, just very interesting to see what one could make of the general abstract apparatus of quantum logic by injecting, by hand, a high degree of symmetry, maybe some topological constraints. I'm not going to talk today, apart from maybe a very brief remark on the fly, about the topological side of these ideas. I'm going to focus almost entirely on the idea of building quantum logics that have a great deal of symmetry. Here's a quick outline of the talk. I'm going to begin with some introductory material that actually reprises some of what I did in the in fact, much of what I did in the last of the tutorial talks that I gave. So if you were at that talk, you'll see a lot that perhaps is familiar, but I wanted to include it both to, I guess, remind people for whom this stuff is not absolutely at their fingertips what's going on, and of course, for the benefit of people who were at the other talk. Then I will talk about, so I'm going to talk especially about what are called test spaces, which are a very simple kind of combinatorial apparatus upon which one can build quantum logics. I'm then going to talk about what I call fully symmetric test spaces. These are test spaces that have a particularly nice symmetry property, which I'll describe, one that's motivated by by one of the symmetry properties that the corresponding quantum mechanical object enjoys. Here I'm mainly going to focus on just definitions and examples, simple examples, to give us some flavor of what these things might look like. I'm then going to outline a construction that lets you build, at least in principle, any fully symmetric test space from what amounts to purely group theoretic data. This isn't awfully surprising. If you've got a sufficiently symmetric object, it should be reconstructable from its symmetries. Then, in a way, the meat of the talk, certainly the new results in the talk, are all in the last section. I hope I don't run into too much time pressure, so I may go rather fast through some of the earlier sections. It turns out that there are some not particularly complicated, some rather simple conditions that one can put on a test space that will ensure that it's associated with a quantum logic that is, in fact, a projective geometry, a very low-dimensional projective geometry. We're going to be talking about quantum logics that give rise, in effect, to projective planes. And then we're going to take those conditions that ensure this, and we're going to see what they amount to in the case of a fully symmetric planar test space, by translating them into group theoretic statements. Okay. At the end, if time permits, I'll discuss. Of course, I'll be very interested if you have questions, but I'll also mention a few questions of my own about these structures. Okay. But by the way, feel free to interrupt with brief questions as I go along, if there's anything that I say that seems confusing. Let me start with a definition. When I say quantum logic, I tend to mean something called an orthoalgebra. Traditionally, quantum logics were orthomodular lattices or certain kinds of orthomodular posets with certain kinds of state spaces. But it seems to me helpful to start with something a little bit more general, and this is about the level of generality I'm comfortable starting with. So an orthoalgebra is a structure consisting of a set L, a partially defined binary operation circle plus and two distinguished elements 0 and 1. Actually, we can define either of those in terms of the other, so that's a little redundant. Such that the partial operation has these properties that you see listed here. The 0 element has to serve as a zero for this partially defined addition. A plus zero is always defined, and if you're going to cover up part of the slide, it's probably a good idea to do it. But all the way, there we go. A plus zero is always defined, and it's always equal to A. For every element A of the orthoalgebra, there has to be what we're going to call an orthocomplement, A prime, such that A plus A prime is defined and equals 1. I require that A plus A only exist if A is equal to 0, so I can't add any non-zero element to itself. Up at the beginning of the definition, you see two things, crucial things that I omitted just now to say. The operation is assumed to be associative in a fairly strong sense, and it also must be cancellative. If I've got A plus B equaling A plus C, I have to be able to conclude that B equals C. Incidentally, and you'll hear more about these structures, you've already heard some of you something about them from Howard, if I drop that last condition, I have the definition of effect algebra. But we'll be talking about orthoalgebras. If you have an orthoalgebra, you can always partial order it as follows. You say that A is less than or equal to B if there's an element C that can be added to A to make B. If you order it that way, then the mapping from A to A prime is in fact an orthocomplementation with respect to that order. And in that case, A circle plus B is defined if and only if A is orthogonal to B in the orthoposet sense. If A is less than or equal to B prime, then A plus B is defined, and conversely. And in that case, A plus B is always a minimal upper bound for A and B. But this is a crucial point. It's a minimal upper bound in general for an orthoalgebra. Two elements may have several minimal upper bounds, and therefore no unique least upper bound, no join, and the circle plus selects one of those in a, so to say, a coherent way. A simple example, or source of examples, is the following. Take any orthomodular poset, and if you weren't at the school talk and you don't know or you don't remember what that is, don't worry about it too much. Just take a Boolean algebra that will serve. You can regard such a thing as an orthoalgebra in which the circle plus is the join, but only defined if A is less than or equal to B prime. In that case, the order defined up here coincides with the given order. So any orthoalgebra is associated with an orthocomplemented poset, and in fact we can articulate very precisely the relationship between orthoalgebras and orthomodular posets. The order structure that arises from an orthoalgebra, the orthoposet that arises from an orthoalgebra, is an orthomodular poset if and only if the orthogonal sum of two elements is their least upper bound, whenever defined. And that, in turn, is equivalent to saying that if you have three pairwise orthogonal, that is, pairwise summable elements, then their three-way sum exists. In that case, we would say that they are jointly summable or jointly orthogonal. That last condition is called usually called orthocoherence. That's a term I'll use again in the talk. In that language, we can say the following, that an orthomodular poset is essentially the same thing as an orthocoherent orthoalgebra. Those are just two different ways of looking at the same structure. And more than that, we can say that an orthomodular lattice is essentially the same thing as a lattice-ordered orthoalgebra, an orthoalgebra whose associated order happens to admit meets and joins. Now, I want to talk about test spaces. Test spaces are very simple combinatorial gadgets from which one can build orthoalgebras. Test spaces are both conceptually and technically simpler objects than orthoalgebras. They're much easier to manipulate directly than orthoalgebras. If one is going to hide part of one's slide with a piece of paper, it's also best if one hides whatever else might be written on the paper. So we're going to be looking at test spaces. Now, to build an orthoalgebra from a test space, you do need to impose a particular condition on the test space, which I'll describe in a moment. Subject to that condition, one says that the test space is algebraic, or to to revive an older term, which has kind of fallen out of use, but which I sometimes think maybe was a good one, we can call these things manuals. So I might occasionally slip and refer to something as a manual. That's just another word for an algebraic test space. All right, so here are the definitions. A test space is basically just a set X together with a covering of X by non-empty subsets. The collection of those non-empty subsets I call fractor A there. Those subsets are called tests. And the intention is that you understand each test, that is each set in the collection, fancy A, as the outcome set for some experiment, just in a very naive, elementary sense, just an outcome set in the sense of your first statistics course. So you want to think of the test space then as a model for, so to speak, a bundle of different statistical experiments, any one of which you might choose to execute. If we're going to look at it that way, then it's natural to define a probability weight or state on a test space to be a mapping from the set big X, which incidentally we would think of as the set of all the outcomes of all the possible tests, into the unit interval, which would sum to one independently over each test, since you expect it to give you a probability weight for each of the experiments in the collection. A little bit more jargon will be useful. I'm going to refer to the maximum, or if there is no maximum, the supremum of the cardinalities of the tests as the rank of a test space. And I'm going to say that a test space is uniform if every test has the same cardinality. The test spaces that will interest us in most of the talk will be very symmetric, as I said, and therefore uniform. So here are a couple of quick examples to help fix intuitions. The simplest test space to consider is the one that you've always known about, though you didn't know it was a test space. Take any old set S, think of it as the outcome set for some experiment, consider the test space whose total outcome set is S, and whose only test consists of S. There's only one experiment, and it has the outcomes that it has. The theory of states on that is, of course, elementary discrete probability theory. A simple model for non-relativistic quantum mechanics as a statistical theory goes by way of what we might call quantum test spaces. There are actually two ways to do this, and I'll talk about them both briefly. Take a Hilbert space H. Let capital X be H's unit sphere. And let fractor F be the set of frames of the Hilbert space. By frame, I mean an unordered orthonormal basis, just a maximal set of pairwise orthogonal vectors. If we're not too concerned about niceties, then we can say, well, an orthonormal basis in the Hilbert space is one particular model for a particularly simple kind of measurement. And accordingly, it's natural to consider the pair consisting of the unit sphere X, the set of unit vectors, and the collection of frames, which we sometimes call the frame manual for H, or the frame test space, as a basic model for the set of quantum statistical experiments. Of course, we don't get all of them, but we get enough of them to fix the states. Indeed, Gleason's theorem tells us that as long as the dimension of the Hilbert space is bigger than 2, the states on that particular test space, that frame manual, are really precisely the density matrices, and the probabilities are indeed given by the Born rule. The probability omega of an outcome that is a unit vector X is just the trace of a density matrix rho times the projection associated with X. If we want to be a little bit, more careful or more attentive to further possibilities, we might say to ourselves, well, unit vectors as outcomes are fine, but we don't really want to consider two outcomes that differ by a phase to be physically different, so we might want to projectivize everything. By the projective frame manual, I mean the manual whose outcomes are the elements of Px, that is the projective unit sphere, so an outcome is not a unit vector, it's a one-dimensional subspace, a line through the origin, and P of fract F would be the projective frames, that is the sets of maximal sets of pairwise orthogonal one-dimensional subspaces. that has the same state space as does the frame test space. So from a statistical point of view, there would be little difference, except that when you try to do conditionalization in iterated experiments, there is a difference. I won't go into that further. Suffice it to say, we have two different quantum test spaces here. Notice that both of these examples are uniform, and their rank is the dimension of the Hilbert space. If I've got a three-dimensional Hilbert space, then there are three elements per test in the frame. Okay. Here is how one builds a quantum logic. Again, that means an orthoalgebra from not an arbitrary test space, but what's called an algebraic test space. To define what I mean by an algebraic test space, I need to introduce altogether too much jargon, but here goes. An event for a test space is a subset of a test. Of course, a test is a classical sample space, a classical outcome set. I'll write script E for the set of events. Now, if I have two events A and B, I'm going to say that they are compatible if their union is an event. In other words, if they both sit inside some common test so that I can test them together. I'll say they're orthogonal if they're compatible and disjoint. I can test them together and I'll never see both of them. They can't occur together, so they can be tested together. I will say that they are complementary if they partition a test. Put differently, that means they are compatible, and if I make an experiment, make a test that tests both of them, I must for sure see one or the other and never both. Finally, I'm going to say that the two events A and B are perspective if and only if there exists a third event C such that A is complementary to C and B is complementary to C. In other words, two events are perspective if they share a common complementary event. Now, at this point, I need to make a quick remark in case people have been thinking of the tests in a test space as mutually disjoint sets, which is a natural thing to think when somebody first gives you the definition. Different experiments have different outcomes. But think again about the frame manual. Distinct orthonormal bases can share vectors, and therefore distinct experiments, at least in that model, can share outcomes, and therefore can share events. Okay. I'm going to say that a test space is algebraic if this relation of perspectivity is well behaved in the following sense. That if I have four events, A, B, C, and D, that are complementary in sequence, as you see there, A complementary to B, B complementary to C, and C complementary to D, then A must be complementary to D. Diagrammatically, that means that if I have this sort of little hook-shaped arrangement of tests, A complementary to B, complementary to C, complementary to D, I have to be able to close up the square, so to say, by having A complementary to D. That means, if you think about it, that perspective events have exactly the same set of complementary events. Two events are perspective if they share at least one complementary event. The test space is algebraic if tests that that share a complementary event, in fact, have exactly the same complementary events. Thinking just a step further, that means that the relation of perspectivity, in effect, partitions the space of all events into non-overlapping perspectivity classes. In fact, it is part of the following theorem that perspectivity is, in this case, an equivalence relation on the set of events. But more than that is true. If the test space is algebraic, then if you take the set of events and you factor out this equivalence relation, calling the resulting collection of equivalence classes pi of the test space, then pi carries a well-defined partial operation defined as you see there. If brackets A is the equivalence class of A under perspectivity, then the relation says that brackets A plus brackets B is the equivalence class of A union B, provided that A and B are orthogonal events, jointly testable and mutually exclusive events. That turns out to be well-defined. And not only is it well-defined, but it turns pi into an orthoalgebra. This orthoalgebra is called the logic of the test space. It's really just a formal matter to see that every orthoalgebra, in principle, arises by this construction. In fact, a simple way to see this is to consider an arbitrary orthoalgebra L, throw away the zero element, let X be what's left. Let frac A consist of all the finite subsets of that set of non-zero elements of the orthoalgebra that have well-defined orthogonal sums equaling one. You can check, and it's not terribly hard to do, that that's an algebraic test space whose logic is then canonically isomorphic to the original orthoalgebra. Here's an example to illustrate some of these concepts, which I know have probably come a little bit thick and fast. I want you to consider the test space that is diagrammed on the left there. The idea here is that the three points along each line constitute tests. There are three tests, each with three outcomes. The corner outcomes I've labeled A, B, and C, little a, little b, little c, and the others I don't bother to label. On the right, I've got the same test space, and I have darkened two events. Event capital A consists of little a and the outcome immediately to its northeast, and then capital B consists of the two shaded outcomes on the other side. Those two events are perspective. They're perspective because they have a common complement. The common complement is the singleton event up at the top. In fact, this is one point where maybe it would be helpful if I actually drew on my slides. Here's A, here's B, and here's a common complementary event C, just that singleton. So A and B are perspective. Therefore, they determine the same point, so to say, in the logic. Call that point little p. Oh, by the way, notice that this test space is algebraic by default. I can never actually create non-trivially one of those sort of hook-shaped configurations of events. If A is orthogonal to C and C is orthogonal to B, what can B be orthogonal to? Well, the only choice is C, which is already orthogonal to A, or rather complementary to A. So this thing is in a way too small and too simple to be algebraic in an interesting way, but it is algebraic in an uninteresting way. All right, to continue, notice that this point P in the logic corresponding to either of these two events. Contains within it, or has below it in the ordering on the logic, two points, the one labeled A and the one labeled B, which give rise themselves to equivalence classes in the logic. Those equivalence classes are each less than or equal to this point P in the logic. However, their sum would correspond to this event, the event consisting of those two points. That's brackets A plus brackets B, if you like. And that event is not underneath P. Roughly speaking, that event is not contained in either A or B, nor is it perspective to anything that is contained in A or B. So that's an example in which arguing just a little bit further, you can see that those two elements, A and B, don't have a well-defined least upper bound. They have an orthogonal sum, but they're also each under the point P, and it's not hard to see that the point P is also a minimal upper bound for those two, and they're different. So that's a non-orthocoherent orthoalgebra, an orthoalgebra that's not an orthomodular poset. I'll say a little bit more in a moment about just when an orthoalgebra is an orthomodular poset or an orthomodular lattice. Here are two further examples very quickly. If X is a single outcome set and script A is the single test that goes with that, then the corresponding logic is just the power set of each, just that Boolean algebra. If you start with the quantum test space, X frac F, that's algebraic, not hard to see, and its logic is the usual projection lattice. Now, returning to the question, when is an orthoalgebra arising from a test space orthocoherent or lattice ordered? A test space is orthocoherent. Remember, an orthoalgebra is orthocoherent if pairwise orthogonal triples of points have well-defined sums. A test space is orthocoherent if every pairwise orthogonal triple of events is compatible, that is, unions to an event. I also need the following concept. A square in a test space is a set of four outcomes, x, y, u, and v, so that x is orthogonal to y is orthogonal to u, u to v, and v to x, and with no other pairs orthogonal, but especially with, let's see, x not orthogonal to v and y not orthogonal to, how does this go? X not orthogonal to u and y not orthogonal to v. The following result is usually called the loop lemma, and it goes back originally to Dick Ricci's thesis, I think, which is, if Dick's in the audience, is that 1966? Is that the right date? Okay. And it's really one of the cornerstones of the abstract study of orthomodular structures. That wasn't proved originally. In terms of test spaces, a more recent version is due to Faulis, Ricci, and Rudiman, and I'm specializing just a little bit, so this is actually a slightly less powerful version than theirs. It looks like this. If you have an algebraic test space of finite rank, meaning that all the tests are finite and there's a finite upper bound to how large they can be, then the logic is lattice ordered, and thus an orthomodular lattice, if and only if the test space is orthocoherent and square free. So those two conditions are sufficient to make the thing have a lattice ordered logic. Okay. Let's say that a test space is Ricci, which seems like a wonderful adjective to me. sorry, Dick. So let's say that a test space is Ricci if, first of all, the tests each have at least three outcomes. And secondly, the if you give me two distinct tests, E and F, in the test space, their intersection consists either of one point or of nothing. They're either disjoint or they overlap in a single outcome, as in the diagram we had a moment ago. Notice that the three-dimensional projective frame manual is Ricci, not the regular frame manual, because two orthonormal bases can share two vectors and differ in the third vector by a phase. So there would be two frames that overlap in two vectors. But projectively, that can't happen. Projective frames either agree or are disjoint or overlap in a single projective point. Let's call a K-chain in a test space a finite sequence of tests that intersect in sequence but don't intersect otherwise. So one test intersects its neighbors in the sequence but not the others, except possibly at the end. We might allow E1 to intersect EK. If that last is not empty, we call the chain a K-loop. There's an asterisk there. That's a reminder to me that I screwed this definition up, and I should correct it. I do need to specifically exclude things like this. If that's E1 and that's E2 and that's E3, then E1 intersects E2, E2 intersects E3, E3 intersects E1, and that would fit the definition I actually wrote down, but I don't want it, so add that condition. Things like that are allowed. For for loops and so on, it's not necessary to make that exclusion. All right, here are a couple of little pictures. That's what I mean by a K-chain with K equal 4. That's what I mean by a for loop, right? If the tests loop around, it's a loop. Little remark, I'll almost skip. A Ricci test space is algebraic by default, just as was that triangular one a moment ago. And therefore, they all give rise to orthoalgebras. For Ricci test spaces of finite rank, the previous theorem takes this form, which is very agreeable. A Ricci test space has a lattice-ordered logic if and only if it contains no loops of order 3 or 4. The shortest loop is of order 5. That's why it's called the loop lemma. Howard, am I correct that I have about 15 minutes left? Where is Howard? Oh, okay, that's a good reason. Yeah, okay, good. All right, so I've exhausted two-thirds of my time on the very first introductory section of my talk. Go figure. But perhaps that's all right. All right, let me introduce you to fully symmetric test spaces. Here's a property that the frame test space has. It's an obvious property. Give me two frames, frame 1, frame 2. I better put all this hardware away properly. Good. Frame one, frame two. Now, give me a matching. Just give me a bijection between these three vectors and these three vectors. I don't care how you do it. There is a unique unitary mapping, a unique symmetry, well, specifically unitary symmetry of that frame test space that maps this test onto this test in a way consistent with your specified matching, and any matchings allowed. That's an extremely strong symmetry property. I'm not going to talk about them, but I call test spaces that have formally that same symmetry property, that any bijection between any two tests is implemented by a unique symmetry of a certain type, strongly symmetric. I'm going to look at something slightly weaker. Consider not the full or the basic frame test space, but the projective test space, where I'm not looking at unit vectors, but one-dimensional subspaces. Again, give me two projective frames, a bijection from one to the other. You can find a unitary that implements that. How? We'll just pick an orthonormal basis, one vector from each of the the lines in each of the, in the frames. But it's not unique, right? Because I've got lots of phase choices I could make. That's a situation that we can make sense of in any test space, and that's essentially what I mean by a fully symmetric test space. Any bijection between any two tests implemented by a symmetry, but not necessarily uniquely. So. But I need to say something about the notion that I might restrict the set of symmetries that I'm looking at. So let me back up a little bit. Suppose you've got a group G and a test space XA. I'm going to say that the test space is a G test space if I have specified an action of the group G on the set X that permutes the tests. That seems like a natural notion. Certainly, for instance, the frame test space would be a UN, let's say the frame test space in dimension N would be a UN test space. I can let the unitary group act on that critter. And the projective test space would also be a UN test space. Okay, so here's the formal definition. A G test space is fully symmetric with respect to G. If any two tests have the same cardinality, I need to specify that, it has to be uniform. And for any bijection between any two tests, there's always some element of the group that maps the one test to the other in accordance with the specified bijection. If the element is unique, then X, as I said, is strongly symmetric. Here are some quick examples. A classical test space is always, of course, fully, in fact, strongly symmetric under its full symmetry group. The frame manual of the Hilbert space is strongly symmetric, as I just said, with respect to the Hilbert space's unitary group. And the projective frame manual is fully, but not strongly symmetric under that same group. Now, I'm going to show you some examples to illustrate that fully, or for that matter, even strongly symmetric algebraic test spaces can still be very far from, well, here it says says L of H, but I should probably have said script F of H. You can be very, very far from any contact with Hilbert space quantum mechanics and still enjoy this symmetry property, which from the point of view of a physicist might be disappointing, but from the point of view of a mathematician is actually kind of nice because it means there's something new perhaps going on here. Here's a class of examples. Uniform partitions. Take a set X, look at all the possible partitions of X into blocks, into a fixed number, a given number of blocks of a given size. So for example, if the set X has cardinality n times k, then let X be the set of k element subsets of S, and let script A be the set of all partitions of S into n different k element blocks. That's a fully symmetric test space, because if I have any two bijections between two of these partitions, I can always extend that to a permutation of the, it is dictated by a permutation of the underlying set, albeit not uniquely. It's worth noticing here, though I won't prove it, that this kind of test space typically does have four loops, not three loops, but four loops. So it gives you an orthomodular poset as its logic, but not an orthomodular lattice. Here are some other examples. N by N grids are obviously fully symmetric. I can interchange rows or columns by symmetries of the grid. And by transposing, I can get rows to columns. I can permute, therefore. I can introduce any old permutation, any old. I can induce any bijection between any row and any column by appropriate permutation of the grid. There's a cryptic remark here that I won't even quote because I'm short of time. Here's a weird example. Consider a projective geometry. Let's say the Fano plane here. The definition of a projective geometry is written up there, but let's just look at the picture. It turns out that projective planes, regarded in a slightly perverse way, not as indeed sets of lines in some projective space, but as Ricci diagrams for test spaces, are always fully symmetric. Regarded as Ricci test spaces, they have logics. Those logics are always non-orthocoherent. It's a funny thing. I don't really know what to make of it. But any projective plane gives you a non-orthocoherent orthoalgebra, and therefore, and a highly symmetric one. Very strange. So the test space is fully symmetric always. I say strongly here with a question mark. I think it's strongly symmetric, but I'm not 100% sure. I haven't quite finished verifying that. All right, here are some examples. I apologize for the handwritten slide, but I botched the LaTeX slide, and after decorating it with a lot of ink, I decided it was too far gone, so I would just reproduce the content by hand. Every Platonic solid gives you an interesting fully symmetric test space. In fact, in general, strongly symmetric. Up there, consider the tetrahedron. Here's how to make a test space of it. Take each point and think of the point as labeling a test, and think of the edges emanating from that point as the outcomes. Then you've got a test space. I start with the tetrahedron there. On the right is the corresponding Ricci diagram with one particular test and its three outcomes labeled, so you can see what's going on. And you can easily reconstruct the rest of it by yourself. It's fully symmetric, obviously, right? The tetrahedron is highly symmetric. I can certainly, just under its dihedral group, I can interchange any two edges emanating from a vertex by a reflection, and I can map any vertex to any other. It's fully symmetric. The cube gives you another one, which you see over there on the right, that sort of hexagon with the two triangles in the middle, by the way, are really just an easier way to read the diagram. They really stand for circles, so they are tests. Notice that there are three edges around a face of the tetrahedron. That gives you a free loop in the corresponding Ricci diagram, so that's not orthocoherent. In the case of the cube, you have four edges around a face. That gives you a for loop. It's perhaps orthocoherent. In fact, it is. But it's not a lattice. I can't, good sense forbids me even to attempt to draw a dodecahedron freehand. Some people could do it, but I'm not one of them. So I didn't bother. But if you think about it and picture it in your mind, the dodecahedron has, its faces are pentagons. So you've got five loops, but you have no loops of order three or four. So that does give you a fully symmetric orthomodular lattice, but not one that's very much tied to Hilbert space. It's very different from that. Finding lattice-ordered, fully symmetric, finite lattice-ordered, fully symmetric gadgets is not so easy. The dodecahedron was one example we kind of came up with later, but my student, Quan Tran, came up with that thing, which is sort of a generalization of that hexagonal thing, and that also seems to work. And it's much smaller than the dodecahedron model. So some of these things don't have to come from anything that's obviously geometric. There's a fair amount of freedom. All righty. My time is getting very short. So I'm going to do this very quickly. If you want to build a fully symmetric test space and not just hack one together, you can always do this. Take a set E. That's going to be a template for a standard test. Pick a point, x0, on that standard test. Skip that line. I don't really need it. Take a group H acting on the set E. Could be the symmetric group of E, but it could be something bigger. But make sure that it acts in such a way that it acts as the full symmetry group, so that every permutation of E is implemented by something in H. Now pick a bigger group G that contains H. Choose a subgroup K of G that intersects H in the stabilizer in H of the point x0. Just do that. Now define X to be G mod this new subgroup K, and you can embed E in X by this mapping. Just take S, once again I've left off a subscript, take SX0 to SK for every S in that should be G. That turns out to be a well-defined H equivariant injection. Oh, I'm sorry, pardon me, that's in H, because SX0 would be in E, and therefore, yeah. Now, finally, let script A be the orbit of the set E as embedded in X under the action of the largest group G. That always gives you a fully symmetric G test space that contains E and has K acting as the stabilizer of X0 in E. Now, that doesn't automatically give you something algebraic, but there's a nice condition that makes it algebraic. Turns out that test space is algebraic if and only if, for every subset of this basic test E, the group F sub A that fixes each point in A, not that fixes the set A, but that fixes every point in A, commutes in a weak sense with the fixing group of the complement of A. That little group theoretic condition dictates is equivalent to algebraicity. Quick remark on the fly, all of this can be topologized very nicely. If you're interested in that, the details are on a paper that's available, I guess, from my website. In my remaining, what shall we say, 2 minutes, something like that? All right. I'm going to talk very, very quickly, I'm afraid too quickly, about planar test spaces. So here's an actual question. Give me a G-symmetric, fully G-symmetric test space, let's say of small rank. When is it isomorphic to a frame test space or a projective frame test space? Let's look at a restricted version of the problem and consider only fully symmetric Grigi test spaces of rank 3. 3 outcomes per test, each test intersects in one point or not at all, or the 2 tests intersect either in one point or not at all, or indeed they're the same. Results of this section are a little bit preliminary, but I think they're very interesting. Here's a definition, which I think goes back to Dave, although I may have modified it a little bit. Call a test space, or say rather that a test space has the plane property, if for every pair of outcomes, X and Y, X perp, by that I mean the set of outcomes orthogonal to X, intersects Y perp non-emptily. I can say it that way. In other words, if given any 2 outcomes, there's always a 3rd outcome orthogonal to both of them. The following theorem, I think, is kind of folkloric, but I also kind of think it's probably due to Dave originally. I think I sort of learned this from you a long time ago, Dave, but maybe not. That's my sense of it. Take a non-classical, that means it's got more than one test, a non-classical Grigi test space of rank 3 that has the plane property and has no 3 loops or 4 loops. Let fancy L be the set of sets of the form X perp. X perp is the set of all points, all outcomes orthogonal to X. So for each X, consider that set X perp. Then X, together with this collection script L, is in fact an orthocomplemented projective plane. And it's isomorphic to the logic of the test space. The proof is sketched here. Probably these slides will be available at some point. I'm going to have to let you read the details there, but it's not awfully hard. Right. Now, suppose I've got a fully symmetric G test space constructed as in the previous section from a basic 3-element test E. I've got groups H and K as before. K is the stabilizer of X0. Choose and fix an element sigma of H that doesn't fix X0, that's not in K. So sigma is some element of H that moves things in E0 around. Maybe it sends X0 to X1. In that case, the conjugate of K by sigma is the stabilizer of X1. And using that fact and the assumptions we've made, it's not very hard to see that the test space is Grigi if and only if K intersects that conjugate just in the identity. So if the stabilizer of X0 and its conjugate by sigma are, so to speak, disjoint, not really disjoint, but meet trivially, then that's equivalent to being Grigi. Now, we might want to ask ourselves, what about the other conditions in the preceding theorem? Can those be translated into statements about the group G, the group H, the group K, and maybe this special element sigma? They can be. I'm going to skip this little discussion so as to finish on time. A quick lemma says that any element of the test space of the form AX0, that could be anything, A an element of the big group G, is orthogonal to X0 if and only if the group element A belongs to this double coset, K sigma K. And a corollary of that is that if you have 2 elements of your test space, AX0 and BX0, they're orthogonal if and only if the difference of those group elements, B inverse times A, is in K sigma K. There are some remarks here. I'll just mention this one. If you have, say, the orthogonal group acting on three-dimensional real Hilbert space with K the stabilizer of the North Pole, then a double coset like this, K, say KGK, essentially is the line of latitude around the North Pole that goes through the point G times the North Pole. And accordingly, K sigma K, which we saw before, was sort of, well, that's the equator. So our previous lemma says in some metaphorical way that AX0 is orthogonal to X0 if and only if AX0 is on the equator, which is right for the sphere. Quick corollary, easy to see from what's gone before that K sigma K is equal to K sigma inverse K. That's useful in proving this next thing, which strikes me as very interesting. The test space has the plane property if and only if the full group G is equal to K sigma inverse, capital K, sigma K. In other words, everything in the group must be expressible as, so to say, a rotation around the North Pole, a rotation around sigma times the North Pole on the equator, and then another rotation about the North Pole. Well, that's familiar from spherical geometry. That turns out to be a consequence of our general assumptions. And of course, in passing, it means that G has to be generated by sigma K. The other assumptions come down to this. The test space is orthocoherent if the groups obey this condition. The double coset and the conjugate of K by sigma is contained in H, and squared efficient if this property is satisfied, that if you have two points in this double coset that corresponds to the equator, or two group elements that correspond to such points, if you put them together with sigma in between and find that that's still on the equator, so to call it, it must be because either A sigma was in K or sigma B was in K for one of the two trivial reasons. That seems like an interesting group theoretic property. I have to admit that at this point, I haven't gotten much further. I'm sure that these things have some kind of deeper group theoretic significance, and if I knew a little more group theory, I'd probably see it right away, but I'm still looking. At any rate, there if nothing else, very pleasing group theoretic properties. Three quick questions, and then I'll conclude. We just saw when it is that a fully symmetric Ricci test space of rank 3 is planar. It gives you a projective plane. But when is it disargon? When does its corresponding logic form not just a projective plane, but a disargon projective plane? When a Papian projective plane? To coordinatize, you'd like those things. That was question one. This is also question one, it seems. What does the category of fully symmetric G test spaces or algebraic G test spaces look like? Does it have a tensor product? Third question, I think the most interesting, though it's for another day, what's the structure of a fully symmetric algebraic G test space of rank 3 under the action of a compact connected Lie group? I bet that that's pretty restricted. And if you have any ideas, I'd be delighted to hear them. Thank you very much. You know, I haven't, but that's a great suggestion. I've sort of only fairly recently learned from talking with Howard and Chris and some other people what a mutually unbiased basis is. But yeah, you could look at the set of mutually unbiased bases. That's some kind of a subtest space of the set of all the bases, and it'd be interesting to know what sorts of properties it has. It, you know, generates some kind of a logic, presumably, and what would that look like? Thank you. Well, they cover whatever they cover. That is to say, you take their union, and that's your X. Oh, I didn't say it would be a Hilbert space. Just said it would be some kind of a test space. And we, oh, but yeah, no, you're right, it's not. All right, thank you. I think all we need to do is to hit FRG. Oh, yeah.